I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
This week on Meat & Three, we're exploring the culinary wonders of urban New Jersey with a tour through Newark. We speak to Frank Mentisana at Phillips Academy Public Charter School.
This idea of family style and made from scratch lunches continues to be a bit of an anomaly in the city.
We also hear from Gil Speyer from All Points West Distillery.
Newark used to have an incredibly rich beverage alcohol history.
And we'll tour Aero Farms, the world's largest indoor vertical farm.
We're growing using 390 times more productivity than field farming and 95% less water.
Tune in to this week's Meat & Three on Heritage Radio Network to be amazed at the wonders of Newark. That's Meat plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good evening, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. Today is part two of our series on genetic engineering with Greg Jaffe, director of the Project on Biotechnology at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. And today, we're going to be talking all about the pros and cons of using this technology. This is an issue that, and I've said it again and again, like this issue has been one that I feel like the food advocacy community just like really took a hold of in terms of the desire to see this disclosure law passed. And I don't know if that's like born out of some misunderstandings like in general or among the public, maybe. It's just, I'm just so fascinated. And I think that one of the things I really want to do today is to just put it all out there. Like, let's talk about the facts, right? What is this technology? How has it been used? And let's now address some of the controversies surrounding this issue, right? So like, I kind of want to unpack, I guess in only sound bites, that's all we can do for today, but like kind of pro cons, right? Like how are some ways, let's start with the cons. How are some ways that this technology has been used that has been harmful, for instance? Like in your experience, do you think that it has led to the creation of mass resistance amongst pests? Let's start there.
Right. So I think one of the biggest impacts of genetically engineered crops has been that while they could be used sustainably, they haven't been used sustainably. And so we've seen the development of resistant insects and resistant pests. So that is not a new risk. We have resistant insects and pests, resistant insects and weeds that exist for non-genetically engineered crops and non-genetic engineered pesticide systems. But in, you know, one of the reasons, so for example, as I mentioned earlier, the BT crops, they were developed to eliminate the use of synthetic pesticides. And for many years, they did that. They did reduce significantly the amount of synthetic chemical pesticides that were being used by farmers, which helps non-targets, meaning beneficial insects we want that might be killed by those insecticides, and it's healthier for farmers. But if we don't use those correctly, and many farmers didn't use them correctly in an integrated way with other pest methods, integrated pest management, as we call it, then the pests, in case the insects, started developing resistance to these genetically engineered crops. And so now farmers have to go back and start spraying again. So on the one hand, while they're doing just what they did before, But to the extent that the genetic engineered crops were a benefit to farmers and to the environment, we start losing that benefit. And so we've seen the development of glyphosate-resistant weeds and BT-resistant pests because farmers, you know, in their zeal to adopt these, utilize them and overutilize them in an unsustainable fashion. So I think that's been one of the biggest impacts
that
has been that we now have, 14 weed species that are resistant to glyphosate that didn't exist 20 years ago before we had glyphosate-tolerant crops.
That seems like a real bummer. that's my official diagnosis. No, I mean, what about the... I mean, I think that there is also the argument that I would say certainly Monsanto has used in the past that this is actually environmentally friendly technology because it requires, it requires less input in terms of like less pesticides, less herbicides to be sprayed. But I don't know if that's necessarily true. It sounds like the opposite.
So what I can say is, and this is not a very, may not be a satisfying answer to very many people, is you really have to, so this technology, just like any other technology, it's how you apply it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to look at that on a case-by-case basis. And so there's a lot of discussion in the media and among the GMO debate about, well, GMOs increase pesticide use. Oh, GMOs reduce pesticide use.
Yeah.
And the reality is you can't generalize like that. You have to look at a specific example and a specific crop and trait and receiving environment and decide, you know, well, what was the purpose of this trait? So the herbicide-tolerant crops, their goal wasn't to reduce herbicide use. It was to simplify herbicide use. And it allowed you to spray glyphosate over the top of the crop. So we wouldn't expect glyphosate to reduce, glyphosate use to reduce. In fact, we'd expect it to increase as farmers adopted those glyphosate-tolerant seeds. For those BT corn and cotton that I talked about earlier, there we would expect, and we did see reductions in insecticides being used. So, so that's why I say you have to look at this on a case-by-case, and you can't compare the insecticides that were decreased with the herbicides that were increased. They're, you know, it's like apples and oranges.
Right.
So the reality is that...
It's more complicated.
You know, it's complicated.
Yeah.
And it really depends on the particular trait and the crop and the receiving environment and how it's being utilized and what it was meant for to know what impact it had. So the non-browning apple, the goal there is to have an apple that doesn't brown when you cut it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no impact on pesticide use one way or the other.
Right, right.
So, you know, that one has not, you know, that was not meant as a pesticide increasing or reducing
crop.
Not an issue. Therefore, you know, it would be wrong to put that in. That has a whole different purpose. And we could argue whether that was a good purpose or a bad purpose and a useful thing and whether that, you know, leads to food waste, reduces
right.
food waste or increases children who want to eat apples, and you know, there are arguments made on both sides around that, but it's a different, that's why you have to look at each one case by case.
What about the effects? Do you think that fundamentally this technology reduces biodiversity? I mean, because that's one of the things I hear.
Right. So I don't think it fundamentally reduces biodiversity. Our agricultural system fundamentally reduces biodiversity.
Right.
But as I mentioned earlier, and that would happen independent of whether we had genetically engineered crops.
Huh.
So, you know, the reality is that most of the calories that humans intake worldwide comes from, I want to say this, and I shouldn't be quoted on this because I'm not an expert in this, but from a dozen or so crops.
Okay.
So rice and wheat and soybeans and corn and,
a lot of commodity crops, yeah.
Those big crops are where most of our calories come from. And, you know, no matter how much we'd like people to eat quinoa or boulder,
or lettuce,
they're not doing it yet. And so, but, you know, rice is not genetically engineered and wheat is not genetically engineered. Corn and soybeans are, but we don't see, you know, we still see people eating primarily rice. People aren't switching from rice to corn.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that they're genetically engineered.
Right.
So, you know, the reality is that our food supply you know, we have a great diversity of potentially edible crops, but that our food supply, independent of being genetically engineered, has moved to a much smaller number of those crops for most of the calories that humans intake.
What about the risk? This is the one thing that I, that, you know, when I read about, it kind of freaked me out, basically. But, you know, and there have been cases where organic farmers have been, in like legal cases, right, that kind of pit organic farmers against Monsanto. And Monsanto, I don't know if they sued the organic farmers, but basically like patent infringement. And if they're, and also the possibility for organic farmers and their fields to be contaminated by like Monsanto crops or seeds.
Right. So there's two different issues.
Right.
There.
Confusing.
Our patent system does allow the genes that are being introduced into these crops to be patented.
Mm-hmm.
And a patent means that it's the government gives you an exclusive limited license. So for 20 years, you have an exclusive license to that product. And we do this for drugs and lots of other things because we want to spark innovation. We want people to invest in a drug, and they know it costs a lot of money to invest. And if we don't give them an exclusive license for a certain period of time, they're not going to invest in those type of things. So we have people, and then we also want inventions to be made public so people can then build on inventions. So that's the purpose of the mm-hmm. intellectual property and patenting system. So when you patent something, then you have you control it for that period of time. And what Monsanto did is says, okay, well, you know, now when farmers want to grow these seeds, they purchase a license. When they buy those seeds, they purchase a license to use those seeds once. And then if they want to use them again, they've got to buy the license again or buy the seeds again. And so...
So they can't save them.
They can't save them.
Yeah.
And if they do save them, then they're violating the patent, and right. Monsanto can sue them
yeah.
to get that. So in some instances, farmers have been sued by Monsanto, not necessarily organic farmers. These could be traditional or conventional farmers or GM farmers who have utilized those crops without getting a proper license. And the best way I can compare, you know, to explain this to somebody who's not a patent lawyer or something like that is, you know, for everybody out there, probably most people have purchased a song on iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
And when you buy that song for 99 cents, you're buying a license. You're buying one copy of that song. And if you give it to every other member of your family, you violated.
Like my Netflix subscription?
The license that you got. Now, iTunes or that singer could come after you,
yeah.
but they probably won't. But you didn't buy a right to give it to everybody else. You bought a right to have it yourself. And similarly, everybody who has a computer, many of people have Microsoft Office. When you first download that, you paid $125 for that. There's all these things that you have to click through and sign. Those are saying that you have agreed to one or two or three licenses. You only can use that on one computer or two computers or three computers. You can't give that to your neighbors or your
yeah.
neighbor's kids.
Yeah.
You know, if you did, you violated their intellectual property, and they could sue you for it.
Okay.
So we may not like what Monsanto did, but that is no different than what the music industry does or the computer, you know, software industry or anybody else who wants to protect their intellectual property. With that in mind, you know, there's optics and whether, you know, Monsanto should go after small-scale farmers who are saving those seeds. That's a different question.
Yeah.
But from a legal point of view, they have a right to go after anybody who doesn't have a license that they should have had. So that's a different question than the question you asked about
contamination.
Some people call it contamination, other people call it inadvertent adventitious presence. And that is
I wonder who's associated with either of those two terms.
That's right. Well, I'll leave that up to everybody's imagination.
Marketing.
But what ends up happening is, so organic, so if you want to have a farm in the United States that's organic, you have to follow the organic standards, which is a law and regulations, you know, enforced by USDA.
Mm-hmm.
And under those law and regulations, biotech or genetic engineering is an excluded method. So you're not allowed to, if you're an organic farmer that's certified, you can't grow genetically engineered seeds in your farm. Okay, and if you do, then you lose your certification, mm-hmm. and you can't call that crop organic. So farmers, organic farmers, don't want pollen or anything coming into their field from a neighbor's field that might be biotech.
Right. That makes sense.
Because it might contaminate, or as I said, either contaminate or
be advantageous.
Advantageous presence of something that they don't want there. Now, the organic standards actually doesn't disqualify a farmer if it gets there inadvertently.
Okay.
Okay.
It's pretty hard.
But
to
the marketplace might disqualify them. So Whole Foods or an organic market might say, well, we want to test, and if you have any even a small level of biotech inadvertently in the crop that you're selling to us, we're not going to accept it because our market standard is different than the regulatory standard necessarily.
Right.
So that's where this issue arises, and it arises in crops that are generally open pollinating or crops where pollen can flow from one field to the next. So soybeans, and that's why I always say case by case is also the important thing here, because the biology of the crop matters. So if you're growing genetic engineered soybeans in one field and a farmer, your neighboring farmer is organic and growing non-genetic engineered soybeans, soybeans are self-pollinating and the soybean pollen doesn't go very far at all, I mean a few feet. And so the likelihood of getting any contamination or inadvertent adventitious presence is very, 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 very small.
Right.
On the other hand, corn or canola are open pollinating crops and their pollen can flow, you know, a good distance. And so if you are a corn farmer, genetic engineered corn farmer, and an organic farmer next door, there you could see pollen flowing and some of that crop now having genetic material in it. So again, it's one of these things you've got to look at case by case.
Right.
But you're never going to have corn pollen contaminating or inadvertently in a lettuce field because, you know, corn and lettuce don't sexually reproduce.
Right. So you're fine.
So this is only an issue for the 10 crops that exist and only
a subset
for the ones where there's where pollen or where there's likelihood of inadvertent sexual reproduction.
Has there ever been a case where Monsanto sued like a small farm if you know, where like the seeds accidentally blew onto the field and then, you know, crops started to grow, but it was an accident and Monsanto sued them anyways? I thought that was a court case.
I am not aware of any that have done that. There was a court case in Perry Schmeiser case in Canada where Perry Schmeiser claimed that's what happened. He inadvertently had the GM trait in his seeds.
Okay.
And didn't know about it and didn't take advantage of it.
Yeah.
But the court's findings to that case said that he was lying.
Okay.
The amount of contamination or inadvertent presence or whatever you want to call it in that case was so high that it couldn't have been done through just
accident.
Pollen coming across.
Yeah. Okay.
It had to have been intentional in some way. So you know, I don't follow the Monsanto litigations that they've done over the years related to this, so I can't really answer that question.
Right, right. But this could be an example of like a wives' tale or whatever. Maybe. Is that what it is?
Well, I think in the terms of the Perry Schmeiser case,
well, that
the
was
court
real.
Said,
yeah.
Ruled that that this was not inadvertent, that this was intentional.
And I didn't mean a wives. I mean like something that is, I don't know, maybe blown out of proportion or something,
right.
Like a misunderstanding,
right,
maybe.
Right, right. And I, you know, again, you know, I'm not going to, you know.
Can't comment broadly,
yeah. I don't know
broadly,
about the Monsanto litigation. Do they have a right to sue people who are using their
legally, yes.
Intellectual property without a license? Yes.
Yes.
Do they always pick the right cases to do that in? And are they, may or may not be doing that.
Yeah.
But those are two different issues.
Yes, that I completely tangled up and you expertly managed to untangle. Thank you.
You know, I'm not at all endorsing what they did.
No,
but
no.
I am saying that they had a right to do it.
Yeah, no, that's important. I mean, that's the law, right? And that's...
Right.
You have to keep that in mind. Okay,
just
so
like, I'm hoping, you know, so Microsoft doesn't come after every single person who's, you know, shared one license. But, you know,
or Netflix.
They've now built in all kinds of different mechanisms to prevent you from doing that.
Yes. Okay, we're going to take a really quick commercial break to hear a word from our sponsors, but don't go anywhere.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise in affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Sir Choix was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. Hi, my name is Sam Benrubi, and I'm the host of The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio Network. With this show, we bring wine to the people. Each week, we bring the best guests in wine on, taste different wines on air, and invite our listeners to taste with us. You'll find our approach to wine decidedly unsnobby. You can find The Grape Nation wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
What about some ways that it has been and can continue to be used for good? So you mentioned before about an apple that doesn't brown or brown as quickly, and how this could be, you know, could be really huge for preventing food waste. And I mean, I am imagining there are lots of other kind of opportunities for this sort of thing to happen.
Right. So I think, you know, so this technology is worldwide. And so, you know, in the United States, it's primarily been used to, for traits that help farmers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And some of those traits have environmental impacts also, positive environmental impacts on a case-by-case basis. They haven't really produced a lot that has benefits to consumers, you know, the consumer end. You're not getting a sweeter-tasting tomato or more nutritious, you know, cantaloupe because of genetic engineering, although those might come in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, one of the places that these crops are also being developed is in developing countries. And there, you know, the consumer and the farmer are really the same. And many of those are subsistence farmers. And many of them do lose a lot of their crop to pests and diseases. They can't afford the herbicides or pesticides that U.S. farmers can afford.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just take yield losses. And so this technology, which is embedded in the seed, in some ways doesn't need a lot of technology around it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's scale neutral, and so it can be used by a small scale farmer and make a difference for a constraint that they may have. So what I always say is, you know, this technology is not a panacea. It's not going to solve every agricultural constraint that farmers or that farming has. It's also not going to be a panacea to solve world hunger or food security issues.
Yeah.
But it is a technology that can, in specific instances, in specific case-by-case basis, have an impact. An impact on farmers' lives, an impact on consumers, an impact on the environment. And so shouldn't we be able to utilize this tool where it is something that we need
mm-hmm.
for those instances? And the example I might give is, you know, there's a virus that's demolishing bananas in Uganda, and those bananas are, you know, a major staple crop in Uganda for many, many people. It's a subsistence crop, and there is no natural resistance in the banana genome
mm-hmm.
for that virus, and so, you know, farmers are taking a huge loss, which again is impacts their livelihood and their families. And so, you know, people are working through a genetic engineered solution to that, where they have found resistance and they're trying to engineer that into the crop. And so, you know, so there are instances where there could be very big impacts
What about papayas? We have papayas now, right? Thanks to genetic engineering.
Well, so we had, you know, there was a, that's right, there was a virus in Hawaii that was decimating the papaya crop in Hawaii. And because of the genetic engineered papaya, we still are growing papayas in Hawaii where we might not be. They might no longer exist in Hawaii. Now there are papayas grown in Mexico and other places around the world, so we wouldn't have lost papayas.
Oh.
But to those farmers and to the people who liked and relied upon those Hawaiian papayas,
yeah.
That's right. We do have something there. So so that's right. So in different instances, it can be very effective. And so the issue is again, not considering this as the solution to all of our agricultural woes. It clearly is not.
Mm-hmm.
But if utilized in a pinpoint manner, it can be helpful.
And can it be, I read something about golden rice. Can it be used to kind of like increase the nutritional profile of certain crops?
So golden rice is an example where it is being utilized to introduce beta-carotene, which is a precursor to vitamin A,
mm-hmm.
in rice. And there are many people in developing countries that are vitamin A deficient,
yeah.
which leads to things like blindness. And who get a majority of their calories from rice. And so if you can introduce this into rice, you can potentially have an impact on that. It's still in the development stage. It's not a commercial product. It's taken longer than people anticipated because it's, you know, because it is a nutritional characteristic. You have a lot of other issues, not just, you know, is there enough beta-carotene and is it bioavailable? Will it be uptake by what will happen when the rice is cooked? Will it
right.
still be bioavailable?
Yeah.
Will it be uptake by people who are immune deficient?
Yeah.
You know, have compromised systems already because they don't get enough calories, and so there's a number of issues around it that still need to be worked out. But that is an example, and people have looked to other, you know, fortifying other crops and doing things with genetic engineering.
So,
as well as gene editing.
Right. But a lot of the gene edited crops are not on the market yet.
Right.
Okay. Similar to the golden rice. So I only have time for two more questions. Ish.
I gotta go also.
okay, sorry. So I will wrap up, but just I think it needed to wanted to mention genetically engineered salmon up for sale in the U.S. What's going on with this?
What's wrong with it, did you say?
Oh, no. What's going on with this?
Oh, so genetic engineered salmon has been something that's been developed for a long time now,
mm-hmm.
more than a decade. And it's a salmon that has a gene from another fish and a promoter that allows it to grow, reach its maturity size in half the time. So the way I understand it is normal salmon, you know, grow during the summer months and during the cold months, sort of hibernate. They don't grow.
Mm-hmm.
And this allows them to grow all year round. And so they can reach their mature size in 18 months much quicker than other salmon would do. And so that had gone through the FDA mandatory approval process, been approved, but then Senator Murkowski introduced legislation introduced a rider into legislation that required that couldn't be sold in the United States until there was labeling. FDA decided on how it would be labeled.
Yeah.
And so recently, within the last couple of weeks, FDA determined that the USDA disclosure rule, now that it had been finalized, also covers salmon, and therefore there is now a labeling scheme in place. And the condition was met that was put in the law by Senator Murkowski and Congress, and therefore now the genetic engineered salmon could start to be grown in the United States and then sold to consumers.
I have a feeling there might be continued pushback, especially from the good people of Alaska.
That's what I've read in the newspaper.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Last question. What are some actions that CSPI would like to see from the government and maybe other corporations around genetically engineered crops?
So we haven't really talked a lot about the regulatory system in the United States, but these crops are regulated by, depending on the trait and the crop and the introduced trait, by one, two, or three agencies, FDA, USDA, or EPA.
It's a lot.
It
seems like a lot.
The FDA regulatory process for genetic engineered crops is a voluntary consultation process. So developers of genetic engineered crops are required to come to FDA and get FDA's approval before they introduce that crop into the food supply. And so our number one, you know, priority would be to change that to a mandatory pre-market approval process.
Okay.
There is a pre-market approval process for genetically engineered animals, but not for genetically engineered crops. That's a
separate issue.
Because of the way the law is written, and the law was written well before this technology existed, not a policy decision. But, you know, our view is that there would be value to having FDA look at the safety determinations of these crops and give its own opinion about the safety of those crops before they entered in the food supply. We do that not because we think any of the crops that exist today are not safe or have any harm, but because, you know, but to ensure safety going forward, as well as to give consumers confidence. There are a lot of consumers out there who I think question the safety of these crops, and part of the reason for that questioning is because FDA has not played a very large role.
Okay. How can consumers, what can consumers do, our listeners do, to support the work that you are doing and to get more involved?
We have a website, and people can become members to CSPI and get our newsletter, and you'll see lots of helpful information there. I write a blog on this topic, and
your blog is?
There's some frequently asked questions out there,
and
so if people are interested in nutrition issues and food safety issues and biotech issues, feel free to go to our website, www.cspinet.org, and when at that website, you know, they can find a lot of information that could bring them up to speed on this topic.
Yep, and it is an invaluable resource to everybody in the food world, and I highly recommend to everybody listening that you should subscribe to their newsletter and check out their site. You guys do really, really important work, and I am so happy that you took the time to join me on the show today. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, I'm going to have to leave it there. I want to give a big thanks to our sponsors for their generous support, as well as to our engineer, Jeet Paul. Show music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast wherever they are found. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe and leave me a comment. Let me know what you think. I'm Jenna Liut, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.